Welcome to Eco Living in Action, a half-hour sustainable living show with Maureen Howard. From making your own cleaning products to composting, recycling, keeping chooks and reducing your carbon footprint, Maureen and her guests will inspire you with practical, everyday solutions that make a difference. Eco Living in Action, proudly supported by Sustainable Dunedin City.
Kia ora, welcome to Eco Living in Action on Otago Access Radio, ko Maureen Arda Howe. I'm a sustainable practice educator and communicator based in Dunedin and host of this show. Now this week my guest is Miriam Lanswood, who is author of the book Women in the Wilderness, and I'll be chatting to her about her personal experiences of living close to nature. But first up, I'd like to share a notice about for this Saturday, so it's the 11th of May, and now we're not going to have as much of a sustainable future globally if we don't make it a fairer one, with less inequality of wealth, where everyone gets paid enough to live and to have a future, and safe working conditions. Now, Trade Aid have been working to achieve this for a long time, and this year they are celebrating World Fair Trade Day, and there will be plenty happening this Saturday at Dunedin's Trade Aid shop. Now, store manager Dean Griffiths says that there'll be live music from the Sounds Nor'easterly Choir, and people can try their hand at Japanese origami with store volunteer Mizuho, sample delicious fair trade baking, make a Mother's Day card at the kids' craft table, and enjoy free chocolate tasting, spot prizes, and more, demonstrating how easy and delicious it is to live fair. Now, Dunedin's fair trade shop, Trade Aid, is one of hundreds of members globally who celebrate fair trade on this day as a tangible contribution to the fight against poverty, climate change, and unfair practices in supply chains. So they're hoping to see us all there. So that's this Saturday, Trade Aid, the Dunedin shop, and it's on 133 George Street. So now we'll move on to the main part of the show. And this is where I interview a guest each week. And this week, my guest is Miriam Lanswood. And Miriam is author of her autobiography, Women in the Wilderness, that was published in 2017. And this weekend, she will be in Dunedin because she's going to be part of the Writers and Readers Festival. And we'll talk about that later. But at the time of writing her book, it actually covered the last 6 years of her life when she spent it with her partner Peter in the wilds of New Zealand. And they lived in tents and huts, and they travelled the length of New Zealand. And one of the things that Miriam had to do was to make a transition from being a lifelong vegetarian to being a hunter of pest species. And I'm really interested in how living close to nature can change how we think and feel and what our priorities are, and how living close to nature can be a pretty sustainable lifestyle. So my phone call with Miriam is being recorded on the 6th of May. So Miriam, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's really great, and I've pulled you out of the wilds anyway. So, but you had to come out to write your book and so forth too, haven't you? So,
yeah, that's right.
So, look, tell me, you know, because you're originally from the Netherlands, but and I guess I have been there. It's quite a well, everything's quite ordered, isn't it? You know, there's not a lot of wildness.
No, it's not wildness at all. Really controlled. It's such a tiny little country with more than 300. 96 people per square kilometre.
Yeah.
Very different from New Zealand, and the mountains and hardly any people.
Yeah, it is very different. It was very lovely. I did love it, you know, but and very green. But so what made you and Peter, you know, what got you that first idea of, you know, wanting to have this kind of wild experience of living, you know, really close to nature in New Zealand?
I guess it goes all the way back to 2006 when I met Peter, and that was in India. And I was looking for somebody to climb the Himalaya with, and so was he. So we were very happy to meet each other
right.
for various reasons. But anyway, we walked in the Himalayas for 2 months in a very primitive manner. It was a really great journey. But in the Himalayas, we saw the sadhus.
And you,
they
you saw
are
what?
Women there. Sadhus, those holy men. And they have absolutely nothing. They've just got, you know, one sort of piece of cloth around them. And they actually live in the mountains. And we thought, wouldn't it be great to make a living, not just an adventure and then go home sort of a thing, but to live in these mountains? And what would happen with your body and mind if you actually live for a very long period of time in this amazing, amazing beauty?
So was it partly a spiritual thing? Because for them, I guess it was a spiritual, partly a spiritual decision.
Yeah, for them it's completely spiritual. For us, it's also survival. I'm interested in, you know, could we survive?
Yes.
By ourselves. A lot of people say if the shit hits the fan, then we just head for the hills. And I was one of those people.
Oh.
But now I think it's really difficult to survive.
Yeah.
Without anything, without your arrows and without bullets and without, you know, some rice.
Mm, so you learned something from that experience, I guess, you know.
That, yeah, indeed. Just how difficult it is.
Yeah, and that we need each other, perhaps.
Yeah, for your sanity, you mean? Yeah, it could well be. Everything is so intense, and especially the very high mountains, that your mind goes a little bit different, I would say, different.
Yeah.
And maybe just being with other humans keeps you rational. That's the word, rationality.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, I certainly, being on your own, like I've done a lot of traveling, and traveling on my own, spending too much time alone. But I guess you had just the two of you, which is quite intense as well, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So we get to know each other really well. We've been together now for 13 years, and we spend more time with each other than most people their entire life, I guess, because we're 24/7 together.
Yeah, and you had sort of a division of labor. Like I so enjoyed reading your book. It was just great. I loved it. And I sort of got a little thrill of excitement when I sat down in the evening to read a bit more. But and just, you know, what would be happening next. And you shared a lot of kind of personal things too. But one of the first things, you know, so you, you know, when you were starting out on your journey, was kind of letting go of, you didn't have a huge amount of possessions, but letting go of a lot of what you had just so that you could start the journey.
Yeah, and that's really, really liberating, like getting rid of it all. And, especially all the technological stuff, all the computers, we didn't need all that anymore. And, so very liberating.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic thing to do. I recommend it to everyone.
Yeah, because actually they do bind us, because we have to repair them and keep them safe and all these things.
It is as though every possession keeps a little space in your mind and occupies your mind. You know, it's a little bit in the back of your mind. Of course, you have to look after them and need and pay for it and maintain it.
That's right.
And it frees space up in your own mind, a bit like a computer.
Yeah, so maybe it's a lesson for all of us to kind of keep it as little as you possibly can. You know.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. So you did that first. Did you find that the few possessions that you did have, that they became really, really, really important to you? Did you find
that? Yeah, for practical reasons, not so much emotional. But imagine you only got one spoon and you lose your spoon.
Yeah.
So you have to go back to wherever you came from the previous day, because how are you going to eat? Well, you can eat with your hands, of course, like in India, but some things a spoon is really handy. Oh, you're not. Let's say not.
It sounds like this happened, did it? Or
no, because we always check everything like five times. We've got knives, check.
Yeah.
We have to be really organized to live in the wilderness, in these remote parts, because if you make a mistake, you can just die.
Mm. And people wouldn't know exactly where you were, would they?
Never. Yes. Never knew where we are. We never took any GPS or emergency beacon or... We didn't take anything, not even a clock. It was a little bit radical.
Right.
It still is.
And that was a conscious decision, was it? Not to take a watch?
Yeah, no watch, so we didn't know what time it was. And
and when people visited, because you did have, you know, you'd meet people and stuff. Did you ask what time it was to check if your body had, that you had tuned in to see what time it was?
Sometimes I look on their watch. I don't really ask, but I sort of look at it and see, you know, when the sun sets. Because we know that the days are getting shorter, but you don't really feel it. That's really strange. Your body adjusts just slowly to the new rhythm.
Mm-hmm. And did you find you went to bed earlier, but it was still okay?
Because doing stuff in the dark is really difficult.
Yeah.
We're always very organized with everything is done before dark.
Yeah, I should
like
tell
my pajamas and my toothbrush. It's nicely laid out.
That's great. And we should tell people, so you did walk the length of New Zealand on the Te Arawa, isn't that right?
The Arawa Trail. It goes from Cape Ring to Bluff. It's 3,000 kilometers.
Yes.
So other people do this in about 4 or 5 months. But we got plenty of time. So we took 10 months.
How nice. That's great. And you had little diversions off it too that I remember reading. You didn't just stick to it, you...
No, we had a lot of diversions indeed. We did it when the trail was quite new, but now I would say it's quite busy. So I would recommend to do a lot of diversions.
Right.
Create your own route.
Yeah, yeah. And before that, then, you were staying in huts or in your tent, in places where you were a bit more settled before that, weren't you? But you'd move around in different places.
Yeah, that's right. We stayed... sometimes much as 3 months in one place.
Yeah.
And way in the beginning, we did a year in Abel Tasman National Park and even grew a little garden. Yeah, so we try to do every year something different.
Right, right. Yeah. And, one of the things that really interested me was that you because you were brought up vegetarian, weren't you?
Yeah, my mother never cooked meat.
Right, and so it must have felt really strange to feel that, then you decided that, to be sustainable and to survive, it was important to hunt.
Yeah, indeed, so I sort of, turned the switch on, and because that's what we're going to do. We're going to go live in the wilderness and survive. So I chose to be the hunter because I was really fond of Robin Hood as a kid. And so I had quite romantic ideas about hunting with bow and arrow. And I discovered this was really difficult, physically. And also emotionally with, finding an animal so beautiful. Of course, all animals are so beautiful. And then to kill it so that we can survive in the forest. I had some trouble with this, and I described this all in the book as well.
Yeah.
But if you think of the ethical situation at the moment here in New Zealand with introduced animals, then actually, in a way, you do the country a favor by hunting these animals because they don't have a natural predator.
That's right. And and certainly you could argue that it's much better than eating meat that you buy in the supermarket, because it's had a captive life and these animals have had a nice wild life,
Indeed. Yeah, it's way better, I would say.
Yeah, way better.
But, vegans would argue differently, but yeah.
Well, that's right, but I think everything has to be something that feels kind of right for us at the time, and it's quite good to be flexible, in some situations the right thing might to be vegetarian, and the other situations it might be to eat meat. But for you now, one interesting thing you said that it was really hot, that you were cold and it was hard to have energy when you didn't have meat, isn't that right?
Yes, I never realized that. So I grew up in Holland, we grew up with central heating and whatnot. It's no problem at all. But we were then in a tent in the mountains in our first winter, and we got colder and colder and colder. And we woke up with hunger pains because we didn't have enough energy to keep warm during the night. And only when I caught the first possum in a trap and we ate it, we realized how much energy a possum gives. It's very high in calories.
Yeah, yeah.
And the next day I was warm. The next night I was warm. Yeah,
it's amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing that you, I guess, that you did a bit was foraging. And did you do much foraging apart from animal?
Well, on the seaside, on sea level, you can forage a lot. And, of course, introduced fruit trees will give a lot of, wild apples and nuts and that. But up in the high mountains, there's no such thing.
No.
The only thing we ate a lot of was totara berries and snowberries. Oh. Kilos and kilos and kilos.
Right, really? Wow.
Yeah, they're really nice.
Yeah.
But, they wouldn't sort of take the place of a potato or something. So we always had some rice and flour with us.
Right. And you would hitch in and out to get stuff, isn't that right?
In certain years. So when we walked the Te Araroa Trail, the 3,000-kilometer walkway, we took food for about 10 days or so. It's quite a heavy pack. And then Peter would stay in a tent, and I would walk out to the nearest road, which is sometimes hours and hours. And then I would hitchhike to the nearest town and come back with another week or two food.
Wow. And you were carrying...
And he would hunt on the way as well.
You do sound pretty amazing, Miriam.
Really? Well, the meat has gotten abnormal.
I don't think so. I don't think so. But well, you know, it's all in a range of we're on a continuum. But no, yeah. it's very impressive, and I guess you know your whole day is focused on what to eat and where to sleep and all of these things, isn't it? You know.
Yeah, but we have so much time, and I think that's the difference with most people's lives. That we have so much time, so we see a berry bush. And we just sit down and eat for hours and hours and hours.
Right.
So what does it matter? Yeah. And then, do you want to walk more? Nah, let's camp here.
It's fun. Wonderful because it just gives you that feeling of spaciousness in your own life, doesn't it?
Yeah, indeed. And that's such a difference with if I go to the city and I quickly adjust. Mm. So within a day, I'm also running and I'm also stressed out. Mm. Yeah, it's amazing how quickly the mind speeds up and how slowly it slows down. It takes about 2 weeks to adjust back again to the wilderness.
Well, that's interesting. I guess it's because we've been brought up in the fast life, you know, and that's maybe what our brains are used to as the default, you know.
Perhaps. Yeah, maybe some weird survival mechanism.
Yeah,
I don't know.
But do you think that there are some ways that you do feel permanently changed, you know, by living close to nature?
Yes, I guess, especially the hunting has improved my sense of smell and vision a hell of a lot, and also a sense of intuition.
Right.
So you have to sort of feel where the animal is, otherwise you can walk for days without seeing anything. Those sort of senses, but also general awareness. Because of the slowing down, I guess, I have the feeling that I might be more aware of general things than, say, 15 years ago.
Yeah. That's amazing, isn't it? And I don't know, but in the city we're so bombarded with lots and lots of stimuli that it maybe in that environment it's a more environment where it's simpler and so you can just tune in more easily.
Yeah, indeed. And another thing is, I guess, that I used to have, you know, as any normal person, nervous for public speaking and all of those things. And now I think, you know, it's not dangerous to speak in front of hundreds of people. Now, they're not going to kill me and eat me up. So why should I be afraid? And so I found all these things, like I spoke in Melbourne for the School of Life for 1,400 people.
Wow.
And I was a little bit nervous, but not sort of paralyzed. And I would have been years ago.
Yeah. But
so
I guess
the psychological fear seemed to have disappeared.
That's great. That's really great. But maybe you're also, every day you were facing dangers and you just had to meet them. So you've... Anyway, I guess that's how we cure fear, isn't it, really? Yeah,
the physical fear is real.
Mm.
I have to be careful when I cross a landslide. You know, I don't want to fall down. And, you know, that's a real thing.
Yeah.
Speaking in front of people is not real danger.
Yeah, so you did have to be so careful. I guess you knew all the time that really if a mistake was made, then that could have really serious consequences for you.
Yeah, very serious consequences, yeah.
Well, anyway, so do you think that what I'm really, I guess what I'm really interested in is how getting really close to nature can make us feel a much stronger kinship to nature, you know, and a sensitivity and to wanting to conserve it and help it. Do you think that you've had been shifted in some way that you're yourself?
Yeah, I think the biggest difference is that I feel completely part of nature. I feel completely like the earth is my home. You know, my ancestors came from here and I was born on earth. And I totally belong here. And especially with the hunting and gathering, I am part of this ecosystem. I am like an animal hunting, right? Like a tiger.
Yeah.
And so... that is a totally different point of view from the person who goes in and takes pictures and goes home in the afternoon. And so the desire to preserve it comes really natural. Like, of course we want to look after the water because we're going to drink it.
Mm.
It's really, even for our own selfish reasons, we have to look after our direct environment. And we don't leave any trace, and obviously we don't pollute anything, and yeah, it's very logical, I want to say.
Yeah, that's right. You're right in it. It's not dirtying your own nest.
but I
guess as our lives have become more urban, it is more and more easy for each generation to separate themselves, you know, from the environment. But we are actually, as you say, this is our home. This is our home.
Yeah, but if you live in a city, it doesn't feel like that. It's very abstract, and the wilderness is out there somewhere. It's important to them as an idea, but not as a reality.
Yeah.
I guess that's the difference.
So would you have a vision for, you know, how you would, you know, I'm just thinking of how you might want people also to experience what you've experienced, and a vision for New Zealander, you know, New Zealanders and people living here in terms of, I guess, reconnecting with nature.
How we could reconnect with nature, everyone, you mean?
Yeah, well, it just seems to me that I think that you've learned some really, really important lessons about how to, you know, that have changed you and, as you say, made you part of nature. And it seems logical that if more and more of us had that experience, then we too would have that deep, deep kind of feeling of connection.
Yeah, indeed. I want to relate to you one little story. We had a visitor from Berlin, a journalist, and he said, oh, so many butterflies aren't here. There's no butterflies in Berlin.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's total nonsense. Of course there must be butterflies in Berlin, except he can't see it. So what I think is that our mind cannot see that there is still so much wilderness out there, because we're with our nose in the computers and that. We're living inside. Most people living in cities and that. So I think the problem with the earth in general is not that that it's getting destroyed, but that our mind has changed and we cannot relate to it. You understand what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I know if I go out into nature, it takes me a little while just to settle into it and start seeing things.
Yeah.
And then I start seeing things, but right, and I allow myself, I know that this happens, so I just have to wait, you know, until it happens, and then I'm connected again. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And I think technology is also a big part of it, but if we go with cell phones and computers, there are little solar panels in nature, then it takes much longer to connect, to see the beauty, the subtleness. You have to go through a period of restlessness and boredom before you connect with nature. That's what I found out. And it's a very important lesson for myself, because I see it over and over again.
Mm. And so when you return, when you go back, so because sometimes you come in and out of civilization, but when you go back, do you have to redo that, or does it come much faster each time, do you find?
A little faster indeed, but still the mind has to slow down, and the side effect of that is restlessness and boredom.
Yeah, so people need to just relax and know they can go through that.
Yeah, you have to go through that, but people don't give it enough time. So if you give more time, and then you see the beauty, and you can just sit for hours on one place and see the light changing and the birds coming, and they're coming closer and closer, and it's really fascinating.
I'm really amazed, Miriam, how you remembered everything, you know, for your book, you know, for quite a long period of time.
Yes, especially the dialogues and that.
Yeah.
That is because not a hell of a lot happened. So it's something, a big, big event is when we saw two other hunters.
Yeah.
And so I remember very clearly what we talked about, because it was so enjoyable.
Right.
And Peter and I talked about the conversation for, you know, the days after.
Right.
And if I'm in a city and meet, you know, 20 people a day, of course I don't remember anything.
Right.
6 years later. But another thing is that I wrote a lot of letters to my parents and sisters.
Yes.
And when I saw a hunter, I gave them an envelope with the long letter, sometimes 10 pages, and they would receive it. So that was also a little resource for my book, writing the book.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. It's great that you wrote it. Thank you. So, Miriam, you're going to be in Dunedin for Sunday, 12th of May, and if people want to come and meet you or come and listen to you, you'll be interviewed by Jinty McTavish, and it'll be at the Dunedin Public Art Gallery. But people need to book and go and book online. So it's between 4:30 and 5:30, and people can book at dunedinwritersfestival.co.nz. So that's the Dunedin Writers and Readers Festival. So this Sunday, 12th of May, 4:30 to 5:30, and it'd be great. I'm looking forward to meeting you.
Yes, I want to add that there's a lot of international people in New Zealand. The book is now also out in Chinese, French, Dutch, and German. And that's it.
Well, that's a great achievement. Well done, Miriam. That's awesome. Yeah, so it's Women in the Wilderness, and it's a story of survival, love, and self-discovery in New Zealand, published in 2017 by Allen and Unwin. So thank you so much for coming on the show, and all the very best this weekend and with everything that you do.
Yes, thank you, and thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. This is Eco Living in Action, and I'm Maureen Hard, and today I've been chatting with Miriam Lancewood about her new book. If you'd like to listen to the show again, you can download it as a podcast from oar.org.nz.
Sustainable Dunedin City aims to facilitate a positive, secure and sustainable future for Dunedin. We're local people interested in issues of climate change, declining energy security and sustainability. As they affect our city, Sustainable Dunedin City produces a regular online newsletter of sustainability related events, hosts regular green drink sessions and organises the Big Green Challenge. For more information or to join, go to sustainabledunedincity.org.nz.
Yeah.